We have a news note here. Yeah.
What's you're not going to believe this, Gene.
I'm not going to believe it?
No, you're not going to believe it, sir.
Here's Lester Smith.
You listen very carefully.
I'm listening. Yeah, go ahead.
Guess what happened in Jamaica?
I suspect.
Monumental boxing upset in the world heavyweight title fight in Kingston, Jamaica. George Foreman knocked out champion Joe Frazier in the second round
good
of that
Lord
15 rounder. I thought you'd like to hear that.
I certainly do like to hear that, because I think Foreman's going to be a great champion, frankly. Have you seen his record? He's got
37 for 37,
and some big guys.
Because my grandmother could have licked a couple of them.
Well, I've seen your grandmother, and that doesn't surprise me, Lester. 6'7", 290 pounds. My God, she's tough. But that's a fascinating. Did you hear that? We have a new champion tonight, George Foreman, and. You remember Foreman? Foreman was, there was another guy. Now, Foreman was also associated during that period. It's curiously enough, it all fits together. But Foreman became very controversial at the Olympic Games in Mexico City, it was, when Mr. Foreman knocked out his opponent, a big Russian, a big heavyweight, highly experienced Russian. He didn't knock him out. I think he outpointed him TKO. And when they were all cheering, he whips out of his trunks. Now, how he ever managed to do that, it's not easy to carry an American flag with a flagstaff stuck down in your trunks when you're fighting a Russian. Anyway, he whips it out and
starts. This is WBAI New York. We don't have time for that clip, as I didn't think we would, because we have to hear our full episode of Gene Shepard. We'll play it again next week. It's short. It's Lester Smith breaking in with a news story on January 22nd of 1973, as Shepard was eulogizing LBJ. Well, we turn now to a program from May the 4th of 1966, just 2 days before the one we heard earlier in the show, and it's all about moving and what happens around a kid's neighborhood. Better get to it before we run out of time to hear it. We may have already done. This is WBAI New York. Mass, backwards, and back speed. This is Gene Shepard.
I guess that'll work out, yeah. It's okay. I'm feeling my oats tonight, which can be kind of dangerous. So for those of you who are nervous, and hi, George, I certainly fit in that department, I suggest that you make other arrangements for the next 45 minutes. Why don't you go out and get a beer, or go out and scratch yourself for a while, right? Or feel your own oats. Bring it up there. Cha-cha-cha-cha-cha-cha-cha-cha. Oh, the straws are in the wind everywhere. And just no sense in kidding ourselves any longer. It's going real fast. It's just falling apart at the seams. You know, it's like, what was the name of that guy that had that old one horse? What was it? Somebody had a one horse something. Some deacon or something had a one-horse something, and it went fine for about 6,000 years, and then one day it just came apart, just like the Yankees, you know. Goes great for 14,000 seasons, and the next thing you know, they're batting 006. Well, that reminds me of our civilization. Look at this. It's right here on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. Now, this is a newspaper that doesn't kid around. You know that. This isn't... No, seriously. There are some newspapers, you know, that are just kind of whoopee newspapers. You buy a newspaper. You know the little kind with the crash photos on page 7. The real Zsa Zsa Gabor in four installments. You know, that kind of newspaper. You know what I'm talking about. That kind of... But they're not serious. That kind of a paper. You know that. Well, the paper... That's the kind of paper, you know, when they have their editorial page consists of a simple two-word editorial policy. It just merely says bomb them, that's all. And you know that they're not serious about that because they know, you know, seriously, if anybody ever bombed anybody, then they'd get one back in their ear and the whole thing is awful. And here, this is a paper that's serious. Now, look at the headline today. This is a headline today. They're going to want to know about that. At the time, see, what's so important about something that's falling apart is not so much the fact that it is falling apart, but the exact instant of the beginning of the falling apart. Now, that somehow intrigues people. You know, they're constantly... have you ever wondered why people read history? I mean, continually reevaluating the Ionian Wars. I mean, as if it makes any difference. Well, it's an attempt to find out just where we began to louse up. At what moment did mankind begin to get his foot caught in the door? You know, the door of eternity. Here, now listen to this now. Would you please prepare some music for me in there? All right, here it is. Listen to this headline. I don't know whether you've seen it, but it's a sickening headline. The Denture Venture. Bootleg false teeth. Cutting in on the market. Bootleg false teeth. Cutting in on the market. Sickening. What is happening to our society? I can see it now. Can you see it now? This guy in the shadowy, rotten, smelly doorway on 6th Avenue peering out, see his hat pulled down over his eyes and these people walking past. Hey, psst! Hey, psst, psst! And the guy turns around. What is it, buddy? Hey, come here, buddy, psst! Hey. He looks from the side to side to make sure that there are no cops, no fuzz in immediate vicinity. Hey, listen. I got a set of red-hot uppers. A set of red-hot uppers in my back pocket. Are you game, huh? Sir, I would never allow my shadow to darken the door of a bootleg denture salesman. Okay, Mac, all right. Yeah, square. Hey, stay, buddy. He's off again. Sure, I'm sure that somewhere there's a guy in a little underground rotten factory making underground trusses. It's a sickening scene. No doubt there's somebody making illicit crutches somewhere. Turning them out, you know. Hey, buddy, psst, rubber crutches, psst, hey, wow. What a sickening society. Bring it up there. There are times, lady, when about all you can do, when you're confronted with the gradual dissolution of all you know and hold dear, all that you love, there's about all you can do sometimes. It's just to blow your old bazoo. Just blow your old bazoo. Right up there. Very good. Yeah, sometimes you just can, you know, just blow it out. Blow it out your old bazoo, as far as I'm concerned. But just think of that. It's everywhere it's happening. Counterfeit. You know, of course, I must admit that I'm part of it. There's no doubt about it. There's no question about it. I'm part of it. I remember as a kid did you ever make lead soldiers? I'm not going to tell you the story about how I once made some lead quarters. But... the urge to phony it up and the urge to fake it up is as endemic to man's general nature, I think, as his urge, let's say, to reproduce, as his urge to walk around and stuff his face full of Twinkies. It's an endemic thing. Hey, you know, that reminds me. Don't put that away. We're going to keep that up, and I think that's a good piece to get things off. Did I ever tell you about the time that in our neighborhood there emerged a thing called MD's Folly? Never told you about the story of MD's Folly, did I? Melvin MD's Folly? Well, we all have our follies. There's no question about it. That's a great word. You know, they don't use that much anymore. I guess because we're living in the day of such fantastic individual ego that what would have been called a folly a few years ago is just called a pleasant little showbiz crotchet today. You know, I mean, like the chick that insists on walking down Fifth Avenue with a pair of transparent bikinis on. That's just called go-go. And, of course, it would have been called something else a few years ago, but it's a matter, and I'm not, don't want to commit it. I'm editorializing here. As a matter of fact, I can respond to and appreciate a set of transparent toreadors as much as the next guy, probably more than many of the next guys that I happen to know around. But that's another story. But you know, we all have a desire somehow to spread ourselves. And I remember I'm just a little kid. See, do you ever remember when you were a little kid moving into a new neighborhood? Or have you always lived in the same neighborhood? Well, then you've missed something. You really have missed that period of exploration. It's the same feeling that must come upon a man, and probably will come upon a man, when he first lands on Mars. Now, because a kid, you see, does not have the wide scope, he does not have the fantastic perspective or the wide perspective of things that an adult has. And so when a kid moves into a new neighborhood, it's much more of a traumatic, momentous thing to him than when an adult moves into a new neighborhood, because an adult rarely even understands his neighborhood, even after he's lived there for 10 years, because he doesn't spend his time crawling around it on his hands and knees. He does not spend his time crawling under the porches. He does not spend his time getting to know each individual dog for at least 400 yards around, and how each dog bites, under what conditions this dog will grab your knee, and under that, what conditions that dog will grab your ankle. Which dog will not bite, even though, you know, this is the kind of thing that a kid learns where the interesting garages are and where the dull ones are. He learns where nutty people live and where ordinary people. He scouts the neighborhood for a chick, for girls. He immediately looks around at, what if there's a girl next door? And the period of exploration is far more than just getting used to a house to live in. And so we are moving into a new neighborhood. Now, this was the first day that we moved into Hammond. You heard me talk about Hammond? Well, I came from Chicago, you know, Chicago. And Chicago's a big, big, fantastic thing. It's like New York or Boston. But one day, suddenly, the old man gets transferred, and I'm a kid. I don't know what the heck's going on. In the middle of kindergarten, I'm taken out of Miss Bundy's clutches. I had a couple of things going there. There were a couple of the girls that I had my eye on already, you know. And all of a sudden, I'm in the back of a moving truck, and they've got these big green comforters that they pile up on top of the day bed, and they pile them all on top of the radio and on top of the record player and all that stuff. And I'm piled in the back there with me and my kid brother, and we are being taken to the new neighborhood, which is not only a new neighborhood. It's literally like going to Mars. Because the difference between Hammond, Indiana, and Chicago is roughly the difference, I would say, between Venus and New Jersey. There's a vast amount of difference. Philosophical, geographically, the whole scene is different. Oh, it's just a tremendous difference. See? And so we had been told, you know how kids are told, I'm in kindergarten, my kid brother's not even in school, we've been told that we are going to like it, you know, that whole business of, you'll like it. It's wonderful out there. There are going to be all kinds of places to play in. And of course, we'd already beaten the turf down. I was playing with Heine Faupel every day. Me and Heine had we had Dearborn Street case, man, I'll tell you. We knew every inch of our block of Diversey Avenue in Chicago. me and Heine Falpel. And Heine's old man ran the meat market. Have you ever heard me tell about Falpel's meat market? How the very earliest sound that I can remember as a kid, the earliest sound I can remember, I must have been two. And I'm lying in my bed, and whatever it is I was in, over Falpel's meat market, just off Diversey near Belmont in Chicago. This is the near north side. And it's a real, that area around there is a very ripe, rich area. It's an area full of all kinds of little bakery shops, Swedish bakery shops, and it's full of German bakery shops and all kinds of things, all mixed up, a big hodgepodge of things around there. And this was a German butcher shop, Falpel. And we are living above Falpel's butcher shop. And I'm just a little kid, and the earliest sound that I can remember must have been like 4 o'clock in the morning. It was still dark. I'd hear that clunking, see? Just a steady thump, thump like that. He'd hit about three or four times, and then he'd stop, and then he'd go. There'd be a pause. And then I'd hear my mother. I'd hear my old man. They're mad. See, they have been awakened again. It was 4 o'clock in the morning, and Heine Falpel's old man, the butcher downstairs, was chopping up the spare ribs for the day. He would come in early in the morning, and we'd get these whole half, he'd get a pig, or he'd get a big half of a beef, and he's down there with his meat cleaver, and he's chopping this stuff all up. You know, he was a real butcher. He didn't get it like the A&P in little cellophane packages, frozen. He would chop it up. He would literally butcher the meat. He didn't, he just cut it up. He'd make chops and all that. And this would go on for about 3 hours before he opened up. And it was directly underneath where I slept. He had this big, the big wooden chopper board, and he would just clunk, clunk, clunk. And then it would be a long, pregnant pause after he finished chopping up all the spare ribs and all the pork chops. There'd be a long pause, and then would come drifting up this fantastic smell. It would come drifting up. You smell it coming in through the doors and under the windows. You could smell it drifting in through the kitchen. Mr. Falpel was mixing up. He would open up the back door. He had a kind of a refrigerated room in the back of his meat market, and he would open it up to air it out a little bit, and he would be stirring. You could hear him stirring it up down there. He could smell it. He had these gigantic vats of fresh sauerkraut. Have you ever smelled fresh sauerkraut at say 6:30 or 7 o'clock in the morning? Yeah. What a great smell! See, and that was the whole world of Heine Falpel's butcher shop. Now Heine himself was this kid, and he was the first guy, but he not only had a crew cut. They used to polish this kid's head in the morning. I mean, he had that kind of two big ears sticking out. And me and Heine Falpel, we were the buddies. See, we would go down in the morning, and old man Falpel would give us each one of these little cardboard containers. He'd give us each a paper cardboard container with about a big fork full of sauerkraut. And then he would throw on the top of it one of his homemade pickles. He made his own pickles. You could smell this, of course. You could smell these giant dill pickles, these dill pickles with the garlic in them, with the dill, and with all the allspice and all that stuff would come floating up. It would come drifting up through the floor, you see the whole scene. And he would give us one of these pickles. And it was Heine Falpel's old man who showed me one of the great tricks that I've ever heard with pickles. You take a real big pickle, I'm talking about the big kind, big thick pickle, big baby, a green dill pickle. That's got a little chunk of garlic hanging onto it, a little couple of pieces of clove and stuff hanging. I'm real, the kind that if you squeeze it goes, that kind of pickle. You squeeze it and all this juice pours out of it. It's real, a real juicy pickle, not the kind you get in jars. Well, you get a hold of one of these pickles, and you take the end and you just bite a little bit of it, just a little tiny bite off the end, and you stick in the pickle a peppermint stick. The candy cane type. You stick it now. Everybody says, that's right. This is the old yin and yang or yin and yang principle of the Orient. Now, when you go to a good Chinese restaurant and you order something sweet sour, Now that's literally in the taste sense. I'm talking about the physical taste sense. That is the yin and yang principle, that the sweet and the sour, which ordinarily would not relate together, make a highly interesting, contrasting, and yet a strangely atonal bouquet. You follow that scene? It's like atonal music, which you ordinarily, or let's put it this way, it's like what we would call discordant music, that you put two or three tones together, which ordinarily should not mathematically go. It's the jangling of these together that produces a fascinating sum and interesting overtones. And so you take this peppermint cane and you jab it down into it. Now it's got to be the kind that is hollow. You know the kind of peppermint cane that has it's porous, the big kind you get. Now I don't mean it's hollow, but it's porous. It's really got little holes in it. See, and you stick this baby down in there and you start sucking on that candy cane. And within about 3 minutes, the juice of the pickle begins to trickle up through the candy cane. And I'll tell you, believe me, if you think pot goes, wow-wee. speaking of the discordant, this is WOR AM and FM New York. Hit it, Dan, there. All the way.
Miller High Life, the bright, clear taste in beer. Miller High Life, the champagne of bottled beer.
There's only one champagne of bottled beer. Sparkling, flavorful, distinctive. Miller High Life. Brewed from a century-old recipe, Miller High Life has a rich heritage and tradition. A bright, clear taste. Unequaled, unquestioned, unchanging. Available on tap, in cans, and in familiar crystal clear bottles. Miller High Life is always sparkling, flavorful, distinctive. Enjoy Miller High Life yourself.
Miller High Life, the champagne of bottled beer.
Yes, Miller High Life, the champagne of bottled beer.
Hey, do you want to hear more about that illegal false teeth operation? You want to hear more about that? All right, they're just saying. No, I just was looking at this article there when they were singing to me about why I should drink more Miller beer. It was everybody. You know, the siren call of the devil is everywhere. Speaking of that, have you got the Cinzano spot?
290 years. 290 years the people of Cinzano make a fine vermouth. 290 years our people are making themselves a crazy, working day and night with no time and a half and no espresso breaks. All of this, so Cinzano sweet vermouth would add a little something to mix the drinks. And our people had to go and let a Frenchman make Cinzano dry vermouth because they knew in their tired, miserable hearts that the French grapes were dry. Oh, what the Italians didn't call our people for this. The names, the dirty words. 290 years. 290 years of making a fine vermouth, and what do you know about Cinzano? That we make ashtrays. Americans. That's not nice.
Imported by Shefflin & Co., New York.
you know, that is a good spot. That's the first time I heard it, and that's a good spot. That is a very funny, you know about us. So we make ashtrays. Isn't that nice? most people think of them in terms of that. But Cinzano. On the rocks. I recommend it on the rocks with a little twist of lemon. And if you really like it, put a little twist of lemon and a little shot of bitters in it. Cinzano. I've even seen it, and this is sickening. I've even seen people take Cinzano and put a little twist of lemon in it. And the slightest touch of creme de menthe. Ugh. I will not recommend that. Let's see. What else do we have? Fleischmann Honda here. Honda. I've been busily out breaking in my 305 Honda Super Hawk. It's a 305 CC, which I picked up last week out at Fleischmann. And I was in a cab today and riding along I think it was Vanderbilt. And Vanderbilt these days, which is in the high red district here in New York, is practically lined with motorcycles that obviously are owned by businessmen who have driven them down to work. And I'll tell you this, if you've never experienced coming to work some morning on a Honda, I would like to recommend that it gets those old eyeballs open. I'll tell you, you're ready. You hit the floor running. When you hit the 23rd floor, you're ready for anything. You know, you take off your helmet, you take off your goggles, and you say, all right, bring them on, CB, and you're ready for business. And if you're looking for a motorcycle this year and you're a little nervous about it and you want to find out about it and you want to know the best place to go, I would recommend Fleischmann out on the island. They're the biggest Honda dealer anywhere. They have a tremendous service department. They will teach you how to ride it. They will get you insured. They will put you on this thing and make sure that it's right for you. This is Fleischmann. And let's see. They're out on in Long Beach, on Long Beach Boulevard. They have two of them on Sunrise Highway, one on West Islip and one in Bayshore. And the big one is out on Queens Boulevard in Woodside, just a mile west of Macy's. That's where I go. And if you go there, ask for old Al and tell him Uncle Fred sent you, okay? And let's see, we also have Rover with us. Speaking of, has it occurred to you that Ralph Nader is the Joseph McCarthy of the automobile world? For a lawyer, he seems to know an awful lot about cars, or at least he makes a lot of noise about them. However, I will say this, that among the world's automotive designers, one of the most respected group are the people who designed the Rover 2000. Some night, if I had a little more time, all I've got is a minute here, but I guess most people are so used to advertising claims that they really don't, they think everything is advertising. But the actual story behind how the Rover 2000 was conceived and built is a fascinating story. It's been written several times in top automotive magazines, and it relates to the racetrack. Two young race car designers who designed some of the most revolutionary cars of the late 50s and early 60s were called in by Rover to design a car with the kind of suspension that makes a race car safe at speeds of 175 and 180 miles an hour. And the result is the Rover 2000 TC. Magnificent car. And if you'd like to see pictures of it, we'd be glad to send them along to you. Just send a note to Rover here at WOR, and we'll send them off to you. This is a legit thing, incidentally. Let's see, what do we have? Miller, Rover, Woolmoth, Honda, Cinzano, we're back to life. Woolmoth? Oh, yeah, I see. Woolmoth, yeah. Oh, yeah, here's Woolmoth. Let's see. We were out, where was that place we were out there? I was measured, talk about humiliating experiences. I was measured in public in front of 6,000 kids blowing kazoos. I was measured at Woolmoth out on the Miracle Island. What is it, Miracle Mile out on Long Island? For a tuxedo. And by George, I'm going to get a blood red cummerbund of watered silk. I'll wear it on the 23rd floor and show them who's a beatnik. And if you've not visited Woolmoth, I'd like to point out that they don't have any finished suits in Woolmoth. They have nothing but materials and design patterns, and you select the pattern. And you select the material, and they measure and custom make the suit to you. And the only suits that are on the premises that are done are suits waiting for customers to pick up. This is Woolmoth, and you'll find them all over the area here. They have 1,500 fabrics. Let's see, 323 West 125th Street, Old Bill. And in the Bronx, they're at the Corvette Shopping Center. Ask for Jesse. Woolmoth, okay? Yeah, back to the word. Oh, I don't know how I got on the subject of Heinie Faupel and living over the meat market, but that was the world. See, I knew this world as much as a kid of maybe four or maybe five, I would say five, knows this world. I mean, intimately. Have you ever watched a kid scrunched down on the curb, looking very hard and studiously at the effluvia that's gathered there in the gutter? Well, here's a guy who knows his neighborhood. He knows what the dogs have been doing for the last 3 hours. He knows what kind of cigars guys are throwing away. He becomes a student of cigar butts. He becomes a student of many things. And, of course, this was my intimate, you know, the neighbor was my intimate thing. I lived in it. It was my milieu. It was, and then all of a sudden, I'm in the back of a moving truck, And I'm there with my kid brother, and they've got all those big fat green comforters piled up all over the buffet and all over the dining room chairs. And I'm sitting way at the top in the back of the truck, and we are being driven to Indiana. I mean, Indiana was about as remote from that part of Chicago as if they had said, we are driving you to Venus. I mean, it was really remote. And so we're going hour after hour, and of course, everybody says it's going to be great, you're going to love it. And the next thing you know, the doors are open, we are hauled out on the green comforters, and there we are in the middle of the sand dunes. And I mean, the sand dunes, the streets are big and wide, and there isn't a car to be seen for 4 miles. The houses are all far apart, and they're short and low. I'm used to buildings. I'm used to Chicago, you know, and I mean the middle of Chicago. I'm used to buildings that when you live on the third floor, that's considered the ground floor. And you work up from there. I had an aunt, my Aunt Min lived in a 17-story walk-up. She lived on the 15th floor. And Aunt Min had muscles like bowling balls just from going up and down. We just walk up 3 hours to go up to Aunt Min's and 3 hours down. That was just a normal trek. And so suddenly, here are houses, little houses all around us. Well, we moved into our house, and we got a house. You know that the apartment, this is something that it just occurred to me. I met a guy last night who told me a kind of a fascinating new sort of psychological problem that is beginning to plague psychiatrists, and that is the apartment syndrome. You know that many people who live in an apartment begin to feel the sense, one, that they can lock themselves in, two, that they can seal themselves off from the world. Now, what happens when that person suddenly decides to move to the suburbs, and they go out and they buy a house, and now that person is living for the first time in his, because you know there have been many generations now grown up in America of people who have never lived in a house. They've only lived in apartments. And all they know is to get in the elevator. Little kids know of life only as in terms of the doorman, the elevator, the cab, the door that locks with the chains all over, and you can't see your neighbor. You never see any neighbors, no neighbors anywhere. And just this little wait for a couple of minutes out there on the 13th floor while the lady that's next door that you never talk to waits for the elevator with you. And you both get into this machine, and you quickly spread out instantly when you hit the... You don't know quite what to say, and the minute you hit the street one way, you go on. Sometimes you even walk the wrong way, because you don't want to walk the same direction with her. Because the next thing you know, you're intimate with the neighbor, you know, talking to them. So what happens to that person when suddenly they're living in a house that has, let's say, a basement underneath the floor? You can walk up steps and you're in other rooms. There are rooms above you, and they're empty. They're your rooms. And outside of the walls, all around you, is trees and space. Now, what psychologically does this do to people? Well, I know one case of a woman in her 40s where their whole lifelong dream was to own a house. And so they finally did get a house. And the house is in Nyack. Beautiful neighborhood, you know, Nyack. I mean, what could be more official, you know? Well, this woman, they've only lived out in this place for about 2 months, and she is out of her skull. She's afraid. Terrible fears. There's no doorman. And there's no place to hide. She has a basement under her, and she keeps thinking she hears noises down in that dark hole under her there. She never had anything like that before. If it was noises she heard, it was just those rotten people down on the 12th floor. But now she has this thing. So they've lit the whole house with floodlights. Yeah, they have floodlights all around the yard so that she can see that nobody's sneaking up on her. And her husband happens to be a guy who is on the road a lot. And so after 1 month, their house is now up for sale. Because she's out of her mind. She's climbing the walls. And they eventually had to go out and get people to come just to be with her, you know, be around her. She's so used to being, even subtly, let's say even without her actual knowledge, she's used to being surrounded by people in the next apartment, below her, above her, all around, people. All of a sudden, she's alone. And all that's next to her on the left is a bunch of trees. Her idea of trees was this was a place where you took the dog out in Central Park. They're sneaking up on her all of a sudden. She was afraid of the trees. She always look out. She thought they were creeping, like Burnham Woods or something. And yeah, and she'd look off to the left, and here off to the left was just a field, nothing. And off in the dark, a shadowy little lump where there was another house. And so ultimately, they just had to give up. She's a true urbanite. A true urbanite. Now, this also affects guys who live in the country, who all of a sudden find themselves in the middle of an apartment world. There is an initial and quite prolonged sometimes feeling of terror. It's a form of claustrophobia to a guy who's used to having trees and space around him and a basement under him and an attic above him. And he's just, no, this is his way. It's like a turtle, or some kind of a turtle. It's used to a certain kind of water. And after all, we are animals, you know. We attune ourselves completely, almost totally, to our environment in much more subtle ways than we ever think. So he, you know, he just accepts the fact that the house and the grass and the trees and the sky and everything else. The next thing you know, he's sealed in a sardine can. And above him are people, below him are people, to the left are people, to the right are people, and no windows. And there's one little window. He looks up, and he sees a little tiny patch of sky. It's at the upper end of his air shaft. And he looks down, and he sees all the garbage down there. And this is it. Well, he has fear, genuine fear. It's like the same kind of fear that you might feel if you were locked in a trunk, or the kind of fear that you might feel if somebody locked you in a closet. Among all the overshoes and all the busted tennis rackets and the dark things that hang in the back there, and he just locked it up, and there you were. And so he gets the same kind of fear. Well, as a kid, all of a sudden, there I am out in the middle of this fantastic sky. It's just wild. And tumbleweeds. Can you imagine seeing a tumbleweed? One of the first things I saw was this tumbleweed rolling right down the middle of the street. Tumbleweed. You can imagine a tumbleweed in Chicago? I mean, tumbleweeds. And the tumbleweed, and about 5 minutes after I'm there, there were six or seven garter snakes that lived out there in the front yard that came around to see who the new people were, you know. And there I was, and the garter snake, I'm used to snakes are in the, you know, in the zoo. Here's a snake. He's running around. And here next door is Bruner. And Bruner, he's the new kid, see. Bruner's walking around. He's carrying his BB gun. And he's ready for action. So it was a whole new world. Well, I began to get attuned to this world. I began to know the scene, get to know next door is Bruner, and he's got this dog named Zero, and across the street is Jack Robertson, and down the street is Flick, and you're slowly beginning to extend. You know, the sociologists call that your range. Zoologists call it your range, too, you know, that the range of a grizzly bear can be marked and can be completely mapped. That a grizzly bear will not cross out of his range. He will not move beyond, because another grizzly bear has that range. And they have a distinct range. And so is the human animal. His range is always changing and shifting. Have you ever considered a picture of the city in a kind of diagrammatic sense? Take a picture from above. Whatever city you live in, Boston or Camden or New York, a place where you've lived for some time. And if you were able to see it from above, in a diagrammatic sense, all the streets and all the neighborhoods, and you could mark the places where you have lived, and then in red, mark the range that you followed always when you were in that neighborhood. You'd go to this barber shop, always. You would walk this way down the street, always. You would take this side of the street. You would always go to this delicatessen. You would always wait at this bus stop. You'd go to this is the range. And it can be clearly marked that the creature that we are is a creature of habit, and a creature just like the grizzly bear. We have well marked and defined ranges wherever we happen to be living at the time. And that period before we have developed the range is that period of insecurity, that period of loneliness, that period of feeling out of it, that period of vague uneasiness, little fears. And you know that as old ladies and old men get older, their ranges get more and more completely defined because it gives them a sense of security. As many people get older, they're confronted with fears that they ordinarily, that they don't have when they're younger or when they're in their middle age period. That they're vague fears, physical and spiritual and psychological, that they're faced with. And so they begin to try to establish a range that is immutable. And that's why old people will always go to the store, or they always want to go to that restaurant, or they'll always want to do this, and they're very loath to move out of the neighborhood. It gives them a sense of security, a sense of pattern, of immutable pattern. And this is incidentally what a kid also wants, because a kid too is faced with fears that an adult is not faced with. A person in his middle or his youth period. In other words, the operating adult ages, he doesn't have these fears. But a child has them. And so he will establish very strict ranges. And so he will take a ball and only bounce it on one side of the garage for a long time. And he will never go. He feels funny about going to the other side to bounce it. He will always sit at the same place at the supper table. He will cut through the same vacant lot on the way to school all the time. Sometimes a kid even carries it so far as that he will hop only on his left foot along this stretch of sidewalk. And he hops on his left foot on this stretch of sidewalk. Baseball players, being largely grown-up kids, also follow those patterns, you know. They're very superstitious. Kids are, too. And so kids are always hollering things like, step on a crack and you break your mother's back. He half believes it. Well, the guy who's 40 doesn't. The guy who's 80 begins to believe it again. He's faced with those same fears. And so a ball player, many ball players will always do the same things. They'll come in and they'll touch third base on the way in from left field. They want to keep that same pattern because they know they've been hitting good. And they don't want to break anything. They wear the same underwear all through the same winning streak. And they will not shave, or they won't wash their uniform. And kids are very much like that. So I'm getting to know this whole neighborhood, say, and the scene is beginning to have meaning for me. When I'd hear a thump, I'd know that that's Mr. Bruner falling down the back stairs, drunk. And that's knowing the scene. And just about the time when I began to really get involved and know the scene, Melvin M.D. moved in. Melvin M.D. came into the neighborhood, and Melvin M.D. moved right next to us in the vacant lot. There was a vacant lot next to our house, and Melvin M.D. didn't come in the beginning. They didn't just move in. One day, a truck arrived, and a bunch of guys jumped out, and they had axes and picks, and they had little stakes, and they began to hammer around on the ground, and they began to put stakes in, and they had a transit set up, and there were guys cutting weeds, and the kids immediately, me and Bruner and a couple of guys, we start, you know, right away, we're seeing what they're doing in the vacant lot, and we're standing around, these guys are pounding stakes in the ground, and finally one of them says, get out of here, you kids, get out of the way. And Bruner says, what you doing? And he says, well, we're laying on a house here. Little did we realize that we were seeing the very beginnings of MD's historical folly. We were in at the very beginning. Now, all the houses that we lived in, all the houses that were in this entire neighborhood, were just ordinary frame wooden houses, some Cape Cod type, you know, just an ordinary house. Cape Cod, over here is a house with that big flat. You know, we had more of the Western-style houses than they have here in New York City or in Boston, with the big, wide front porch. You've seen that kind? With the sloping roof that comes down, and it's often completely enclosed with screen, and the porch is raised up over the lawn goes down, and the terrace. And everybody had pretty much the same kind of house. There were a few brick houses, a few houses that looked like... In fact, one or two of them came from Sears Roebuck. You know, you could buy a Sears Roebuck. Did you know you can buy a Sears Roebuck house? Came in a kit, and you could buy Cape Cod number one. You could buy Cape Cod number two. You could buy something like the Coast of Manor, that kind of thing, with a little widow's walk around the top of it and all that stuff. Well, we had a couple of those in the neighborhood. And then Melvin M.D. began to build the historic folly, which was later to change the entire tenor in fact, the entire philosophical outlook of the neighborhood, and which led to the eventual rise and fall of the Iona Bodkin family. Now, we have run out of time, but if you would care to drop back tomorrow night at the same time, I will sketch the... well, now, of course, today, as I said, we don't often refer to a folly as that. We often refer to it as statistical error. But Melvin Emdy deliberately set out, Mr. Melvin Emdy, to create a folly which even to this day is spoken of in hushed terms. People don't speak of it out loud in certain portions of northern Indiana. And the word Emdy is a word that is freighted with meaning. It is always coupled with Mr. Charlie Bodkin and his daughter, Iona Pearl Bodkin. Yes, this saga will be yours if you will care to join me at my knee tomorrow night. And I might as well admit that I'm getting a little sick and tired of a society that not only grows what we've grown, but also is stooping to bootleg false teeth selling. I think this is getting a little bit out of hand. And just think what they're going to think of us in Belgium tonight.
This is WBAI in New York. For news.
Here, are you a chap who digs hot trumpet or cool bass? Smooth piano or crazy drums? This is Billy Baxter. And I ask you, who's to account for a guy's taste? That's why we've got the Billy Baxter Room at Barney's. So you young chaps can latch onto each and every one of them.
All right, that's it. Gene Shepherd from May, what, 3rd or 4th, 1966. If there's enough clamoring, we'll play MD's Folly next week. But now it's 6 a.m. You're tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial WBAI New York. Stay tuned for Wake Up Call. It follows immediately right here.